This is Pastor Dean Proctor from Queensway Baptist Church in Brantford, Ontario, Canada. You're listening to a podcast of one of our latest sermons. At Queensway, we seek to impact lives for Jesus in this generation and in generations to come. As you listen to this podcast, we trust you'll be blessed. Amen. This is the quote I wanted to begin with this morning. Sam Chand is a seminary professor. He's a Christian leadership coach. This came through my social media feed a couple of weeks ago, and it just stopped me. The church I was trained for does not exist anymore. What's it mean? Well, for Sam Chand, he was someone who was educated and ordained to ministry in the 1970s. So all of his seminary training, his ordination supervision, all of that, whatever went into his degree at the time, prepared him for a model of church that he served quite well in the 1970s. A model and a philosophy of church that today is dead. It doesn't exist. His training would be no doubt from an era where he was readied to go into the church to meet with people who themselves were still attracted to the church. Used to be you just put up a building and they showed up because people were attracted socially, morally. That doesn't exist anymore. A time when the voice, the Christian message, the Christian worldview was actually heard and valued socially. That's not so much true today. It was a church where the pastor needed to be proficient as a leader in three, maybe four areas of ministry. Pastor had to know how to preach, how to lead the Wednesday night Bible study, how to conduct a funeral. That society, that worldview, that church, even the society that surrounded Sam Chan's church that he was trained for, just doesn't exist anymore. I want you to imagine that the church of 2020 is in exile. Exile. We're surrounded by a culture that we don't match, that is different from what we desire it to be. Christianity in our world is not the dominant worldview any longer. The church can no longer assume that people will just show up. They're not. They aren't. The church of 2020 requires its pastor to be proficient in a dozen or more areas now. Areas that were not part of any seminary training. Areas that were not part of the degree that I hold. These include human resources matters, liability awareness, confidentiality legislation, Canada Revenue Charity Law, addiction and mental illness issues, technological advances, and oh yeah, preaching in there somewhere, teaching a little bit too. And I guess that's why I was drawn to this, because it's increasingly true for me. I started my degree program 20 years ago. And as every year goes by, the church that I was trained for is either dead or at minimum is terminal. But this morning I want to suggest a question to you. What if that church, the church that Sam Chand was trained for, the church that I was trained for, the church that you are accustomed to, what if that church should have never existed in the first place? That form of church, that model of church, that philosophy, what if it should never have existed in the first place? What if the way that we've been looking at the church, how to train for the church, the ways that we argue for and in the church, how to shape the church, even the dividing of the church, we heard that scripture about divisions in the church. What if in our lifetimes, the way that we prefer it to be or remember that it was actually a way that it never should have been to begin with? What would that do to your brain? So this morning I want to take a fresh start and a fresh view of the local church. I want to point to something from the scriptures that I think need to tweak our understanding of what the church is, what the church is meant to be. And actually, if we do this, we're going to find out that the fresh view that I'm pointing to this morning is not all that fresh. It's like 2,000 years old. Really, it's just a rediscovering of what always was. So we're going to be in the Gospel of Matthew this morning, chapter 16. In Matthew, by the time we get to Matthew 16, Jesus is well into his formal ministry. If we were to just flip through the pages of the first 16 chapters, you'd see there's been some profound teaching that's already happened. Miracles have taken place. Multitudes have been fed. And actually, in Matthew's gospel, he records two different feedings with the few loaves and the few fish, first to 5,000 men, plus whoever else was there with them, because that's all that was counted. And then again, not long after, 4,000. Few loaves, a few fish. And all of this and the healings has been done in the eyes of the disciples. They've been there with him. They've been traveling with him since he called them. He handpicked them and said, follow me. So they've been with him, and they've seen all of this stuff happening. And it's not until chapter 16, though, that we see the disciple named Peter, he verbally now articulates his understanding of who this Jesus that he's been following really is, that he's the Son of God. And as I'm about to read this morning, Jesus' response to Peter has some deep implications for you and I who are gathered here in and as the church. So I'm going to read Matthew 16, verses 13 to 20. Now when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, who do people say that the Son of Man is? And they said, well, some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, others Jeremiah or one of the prophets. He said to them, but who do you say that I am? Simon Peter replied, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus answered him, blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah. That means Simon, son of Jonah. So Simon Peter's dad was named Jonah. For flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I tell you, you're Peter. And on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven. No, wait a minute. Go back again, verse 19. I'll give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. Then he strictly charged the disciples to tell no one that he was the Christ. So we have to remember that when we're reading the Gospel of Matthew, that the Gospel writer is addressing it primarily to a Jewish audience. Okay? And that Jewish audience would understand things innately, like the laws of Moses and the history of the Hebrew people. So they would know all of that stuff. And so that makes the words in verses 13 and 14 super significant. Jesus knows that there are mixed opinions about his identity. What are people saying about him? Some say this, some say that. But what obviously matters to Jesus as we read on is not what other people say, but what do those whom he's going to empower into the world with the good news message, what do they say? Who do they say that he is? He asks them, who do people say I am? And the answers are varied. As Peter says, some say John the Baptist. John the Baptist is actually Jesus' cousin. Some say Elijah. Elijah was the one recognized in Jewish tradition as the one who would come first and pave the way for the Messiah. Some say Jeremiah, one of the prophets. And that's an interesting one because as we read through Matthew, very often Jesus quotes the words of Jeremiah. Both Jesus and Jeremiah knew suffering. Both Jesus and Jeremiah talked about the practices, the heretical practices in the temple. Both spoke of judgment, and ultimately, both would be martyred. And then kind of tacking on at the end, Peter says, or one of the prophets. He doesn't say which one. He doesn't refer to which prophet. That's not made clear. And again, Jesus says, that's all well and good, but who do you say that I am? And Peter's answer, again, remember a Jewish audience is receiving this first. Peter's answer is scandalous, but it's also profound. He replies that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. So to be clear, he's looking right at Jesus and he's saying, you're the one our people have been waiting for generations. That's you. And that's the first time in Matthew's account that we see this messianic title hung on Jesus and him letting it be hung on him, accepting that identification. That's so significant. That's so significant that Jesus says, and it's on that statement, on that confession, on that profession of faith, that he's going to build his church. The truth that Jesus is Lord is the foundation upon which Jesus will build his church. His church. I will build my church. Let's be careful not to gloss over that. His church. The church exists at all because Jesus is Lord. That's why there is a church. The very declaration that Jesus is the one sent by God into the world who would rescue us from our sin and bring us into a right relationship with God the Father, that is the bedrock of Jesus' church. And to confess anything other than that, to take anything from that or to add anything to that, well, that won't stop people from gathering on Sunday and won't stop them from doing religious stuff, but it will stop them from being the church of Jesus because his church is built on that profession of faith. To be clear, and I mean this respectfully, this passage does not indicate that Peter is the first pope of the Catholic Church. Although the Catholic Church would say it absolutely does, but the text doesn't support that. This idea that Jesus is giving authority to Peter, that this is where the Catholic Church says and this is where papal authority begins. I'm a Protestant, so I protest. I don't think it does. The text doesn't say that. In fact, what the text does say is this clever little word game that Jesus plays with Peter. Simon is his name, but his nickname, his name that Jesus gives him is Peter. Petra in Greek, which means rock. Rocky. He calls him the rock. You're the rock. And on this, I'm going to build my church. On Peter? No. On the confession of faith that Peter just offered. That's the bedrock. Yeah. You're the rock, and on this rock, I'm going to build my church. Yeah, Peter was given authority in the church. He absolutely was. We see that at Pentecost, and we see that after that in the scriptures. But he's not the pope. But this passage does contain two enormous truths that I want to kind of park on this morning. It seems like the primary function of this whole passage from verses 13 to 20 is twofold. Number one, it's the public acceptance by Jesus of the divine role of Messiah. He congratulates Peter for that identification. That's right. Now do me a favor, just don't tell anybody quite yet. And number two, the announcement of the establishment of a new kind of community. A community with a new mission who would be built upon, central to them would be this now revealed truth that Jesus is Messiah. That would be central to this community, this group. And they would take that message and they would go out into the world. And so they're set apart for this mission, and these set apart ones are called, again in Greek, the ecclesia. In English, the church. The gathered, the set apart ones, That's what church means. The set apart ones. The church as Jesus intended it to be, based on his own words right here, is built on the confession of faith that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God, that it's his church. And that first, that it needs to be the first essential piece of doctrine that any local church gets straight. Since today is about seeking a fresh view of the local church, let's stick with that part of the passage today. The parts about the founding identity and the expected activities of the church. So Jesus replies to Peter and says, "My church is going to be built on the profession of faith that you have just made." He's not saying it'll be established on a particular method of ministry, a particular era or dispensation of ministry, not even a particular organizational structure for ministry, whether popes, bishops, or support teams and reverends. None of that applies here. And Jesus also says something about the mission of that set-apart community, the church, that we have to be careful not to miss. It's really actually easy to miss. "I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not overpower it," or in some translations, "shall not prevail against it." The gates of hell shall not overpower it. I want you to think about a walled city or a fortress. And there's a set of gates to get in. The purpose of the gates, I guess twofold, to keep unwanted out and to keep those inside protected. That's what the gates do. They're defensive tools. Gates are defensive tools. Anybody ever been attacked by a gate? You don't take a gate into war with you. It's not an offensive weapon. It's a defensive tool. Read that again. "And the gates of hell shall not overpower it." What's being defended by the gate? Hell. The primary action of the church that Jesus builds is to storm hell, is to make the enemy, Satan, tremble. When the church that Jesus Christ builds is mobilized, the gates of hell are not going to be enough to keep Satan and his demons safe. Okay, so follow me on that. How many times have we gathered and said to God in prayer, you know, we're inside the church and we're like, "God, don't let the devil get a foothold inside our church"? That is completely backwards. We're not supposed to pray that the devil doesn't come inside. The church is supposed to go out there and make the devil do that. Don't let them get in here. So backwards from how we see the practice of ministry. Because that's not the church that I was trained for. I was trained for kind of an inward-looking thing. Jesus says, make the demons tremble. We've often heard it said, if Satan isn't trying to mess up your ministry, then you're probably not doing anything that bothers him. The church was founded to bother him. To bother him immensely. Now, to be certain, I'm not saying, so let's just all go back and be the Acts 2 church, and we'll just do everything that the Acts 2 church did, and all will be well, and we'll be far more biblical and all of that. I'm not saying that, because I don't think that's possible. I've never believed that. I think there are principles that we can take from the Acts 2 church, but we can't be the Acts 2 church, not the least of which is because we're not in first century Jerusalem. We're in 2020 in the Henderson Survey. Completely different. That era doesn't exist anymore. That time has gone. We can't minister like the church did 2,000 years ago any more than we can minister the way the church did 20 years ago or 10 years ago. That time is gone. That era is over, and no amount of nostalgia is going to change that fact. We can't minister in a relevant way in 2020 with 1990 thinking. We can't minister safely in 2020 if our policies are from 1997. I'm going to tell you a story. I didn't just pick 1997 out of the air. 1997 was the first year I ever took any youth group kids to an event. 1997. It was I think the first time that CBOQ ever did the Raptors event for the youth, which has become a huge, huge thing. But at that time, you went to the Raptors game, and then we went to Yorkminster Park, and there was a rally, and Dave Overholt spoke at it in the gym at Yorkminster Park. And I'm like, yeah, I'm gonna take my youth group kids, yeah. So I borrowed a van that the window fell out of in the parking lot at Yorkminster Park. So the thing was a wreck. I borrowed a van. I was the only leader in the van. I had all of these, no waivers, no permission forms, no additional insurance on the borrowed van that wasn't even mine to begin with. And I packed it filled with other people's kids and drove away. I love our youth group leaders here. If any one of them did anything like that, they would be so fired so quickly for having endangered the kids, first of all, but for also for putting the whole ministry at risk by doing something so careless. That was perfectly acceptable in 1997 in the church where we were at. It's a different time. I've said it before, I'm going to say it again this morning. If the church functions today as it did 10 or 11 years ago, it's a dying church. It's not a church that's seeking revival. It's not a church that is storming hell. Frankly, it's a church that needs palliative care. If our goal in the church at any time is to make the church today, to have the decisions we make today ensure that the church looks the same in 10 years as it does today, the church is already dead. And it just doesn't know it. I mean, I'm being serious. I'm not being flippant here. There is no other institution in your life where you would accept that it never changes, is never relevant, and uses the oldest possible technology. You would never accept. You would not go to a doctor who refuses to use one of them newfangled X-ray things. You wouldn't. You want the best care. You wouldn't go to a mechanic who says you just need to ignore all of those warning lights and that whole computer thing because I just can't be bothered with all that computer stuff. Just skip it. You wouldn't go back there. But that seems like that's all we do in the church is argue about what we used to do. I just look back at Shelley. I'm going to call you out, Shelley. I'm going to call you out because it's a brilliant line. Shelley, every time somebody says something like, we used to do this, I am. No? Okay. Shelley, every time somebody says, you know what we used to do? We used to do this. And Shelley says, we used to pee outside too. And usually the conversation's over, right, at that point. That's what I'm talking about, though. That era is over. What were we talking about, Shelley? Yeah, it's all gone now. It's all gone. So the argument has been made, I think, is probably as plain as I can make it, that the church can't be freeze-dried. We can't freeze-dry the church in the state that we found it in so that it would always be familiar and never changing to us with the same methods and the same ministry. That's not a healthy church. That is a dying church and not one that strikes fear into Satan as Jesus' church was intended to do. The church, it may be a gathering of people, and they may have a great facility, and they may have a huge budget, but they're dead. They're nailed to the perch like Monty Python's parrot. Beautiful plumage, but it's dead. So, what do we do with this morning? Two things we can do with what I've just read and said and what Shelley has contributed to it, is we can just reject it. Reject everything I've just said as pie in the sky, baloney, outdated or exclusive or offensive thinking. Or we can accept it as truth, reflect on it, and ask God's help to accept it and challenge us in the way that we look at the local church as we find relevant and effective ways and means to live and express the gospel in a world that increasingly could care less about Jesus. Not surprisingly, I gave my life to number two there. I want to suggest that part of a good, clean, fresh start in 2020 is a fresh view of the identity and role of the local church. You're going to be asking some hard questions this year, I imagine. And I think that's good. You're going to be confronted with some identity questions about the local church. And I think that's good. They may be questions like, I don't know because I'm not involved in it. Does the local church stand on that declaration that Jesus is Lord that we just read? And do we say it first, or do we only say it in the event someone should ask? Is Jesus Lord? Is that the foundation that the church is built on? Does the local church make it a point to strive to tear down the gates of hell with bold gospel ministry that strikes fear into Satan, or are we barricaded inside hoping he doesn't get inside? The church that Jesus describes to Peter, the church that Jesus said he was building, the church that Jesus said is built on the profession of faith that Jesus is Lord, the one that he gave authority to set captives free and give sight to the blind, is not one that hides, is not one that cowers. It's one that proclaims Jesus is Lord at every given opportunity. You know, Jesus started this conversation with Peter asking what people were saying about him. That was just a lead-in question. Can you imagine if Jesus was super concerned every day what people were saying about him? What the Jewish religious leaders were saying about him? That was really not his primary concern, what people thought about him. And his answer to Peter reflects that. When Peter says, you're the Christ. You're the Son of the living God. And Jesus celebrates and says, you know what's great about that, Peter? You didn't just hear that from somebody and think that sounds good. My Father in heaven has revealed that to you. That's something to think about. Is the church operating on what people say about Jesus or what the Father says about Jesus? What is acceptable in the world or what is commanded by God? Are we seeking the approval of people or the approval of the Father? Because here's the thing, those two can sometimes go together, but most often they don't. Most often what we see is that what people in the world who don't walk with the Lord approve of, God condemns. And it works the other way too. The things that God approves of, the world condemns. And so we who claim to be the church would do well to keep those two things in their proper priority, I think, and in their proper order. When we understand what the local church is, what it does, and who it was always meant to glorify. I'm going to invite the praise team to come back together and sing us out.